This is a lecture series from Tikvah Ideas commemorating the Yom Kippur War on its 50th anniversary. Together, over the course of 6 lectures, we're going to explore what we know now about the war and what went on behind the scenes. Ma Nishtana, what makes the Yom Kippur War different from all of Israel's other wars? Or, as Chaim Herzog, the father of Israel's current president and the author of the first English language book about the war, put it, quote, "The basic errors of the Israelis in the Yom Kippur War grew, paradoxically enough, out of their victory in the Six-Day War," unquote. How could this be? To answer this question, let's just recap the basics. The war broke out on October 6th, and it ended on the 25th, a total of 19 days. For the first 8 days, the Israelis were not certain that they would win. October 8th, the worst day of the war, was also the worst day in the entire history of the Israel Defense Forces. After losing hundreds of tanks, the Israelis sensed that they faced an entirely new enemy, especially on the Egyptian front. In 1967, Israeli tanks merely had to show up and open fire, and Egyptian crews would abandon their own tanks, leave their boots in the sand, and run away barefoot. This time, the Egyptians not only held their ground tenaciously, but they fought back in innovative ways. The Egyptian and Syrian armies pushed Israel to the edge, and Israel glimpsed the abyss. In today's episode, we will examine the military dimensions of the 1973 crisis, with an eye to understanding how the country that won an historic victory in the Six-Day War was nearly defeated just 6 years later. In the last lecture, we discussed the Agronaut Commission, the formal committee of inquiry set up to investigate the failures of the war, and how its interim report has shaped all of the subsequent Israeli debate about these questions. Crucial to its explanation, you'll remember, was Ha Conceptia, the conception. This was the conviction held by intelligence officials and high policymakers alike that the Syrians could not start a war without Egypt, that the Egyptians would not start a war that they could not win, and that they couldn't win without air superiority, which required, among other things, long-range bombers. So good was Israeli intelligence on Egypt that the senior most intelligence officer, Eli Zeira, began to believe that he completely understood the intentions of President Anwar Sadat, the grand architect of the war. Any attempt to explain the near total defeat of Israel must begin with this remarkable Egyptian leader. "War is the continuation of politics by other means," said Karl von Clausewitz. His dictum advises us, before talking about the clash of armies, to acquaint ourselves with Sadat's political goals, which were as innovative and as poorly understood by Israel as his military tactics. In the next episode, we will survey Sadat's diplomatic vision and how, thanks to the Egyptian performance in the Yom Kippur War, it helped shape the modern Middle East. Today, we will focus purely on how that vision influenced the clash of armies and how Israel reacted to it. Sadat's war differed from the 4 preceding wars between Egypt and Israel: the War of Independence in 1948, the Suez-Sinai Campaign in 1956, the Six-Day War in 1967, and the War of Attrition of 1969 to 1970. The last 3 of these were run by Gamal Abdel Nasser and were all parts of the attempt to project influence into the wider Arab world. We don't need to go into this question too deeply, but just to give one example, in 1956, Nasser organized Palestinian terrorist attacks against Israel, much as Iran does today, from Gaza, Jordan, and Lebanon. But in his case, Nasser's primary goal was to appeal to the Palestinians of Jordan in order to delegitimate the British forces there by painting them as Israel's ally. In short, the operations against Israel were a bank shot. By contrast, the Yom Kippur War, Sadat's war, was focused and highly disciplined. Israel was the military target as well as the political one. His primary goal was to regain the territory that Israel acquired from Egypt in the Six-Day War of 1967. That conflict had shifted the balance of power decidedly in favor of Israel. A purely diplomatic path to rolling back the Israelis simply did not exist, nor did a purely military solution. because the Israelis were too powerful for the Egyptians to dislodge from Sinai by force. By default, Sadat landed on a combined political-military strategy based on the following four moves. First, striking a mighty blow against Israel in the first round of the war. The blow must kill as many soldiers as possible so that it will leave the government of Prime Minister Golda Meir reeling. Well acquainted with Israel's sensitivity to casualties, Sadat calculated that, while he couldn't uproot the Israelis militarily from the Sinai Peninsula, he could at least bleed it. A high body count would shake the Israeli leaders so severely that they would doubt whether permanently holding on to the Sinai Peninsula was really worth the cost. Second, crossing the Suez Canal from Africa into Asia, occupying the western tip of the peninsula and holding it until the end of the war. By occupying, in Sadat's words, even 4 inches of the Sinai territory, he would bolster his claim to the entire peninsula. Third, mobilizing the Arab world behind this effort. That meant enlisting as a military ally Hafez al-Assad of Syria and as a political ally King Faisal of Saudi Arabia. The Syrian military would advance in the Golan Heights, which Israel took from Syria in 1967, with the intention of applying to that territory the same principles that Sadat intended to apply to the Sinai Peninsula. Meanwhile, Faisal would threaten the West with the oil weapon. Fourth, shaking up the superpowers and playing them off against each other. The Middle East in 1973 had become a military laboratory between the two global blocs. From the early days of the Cold War until the 1980s, the Warsaw Pact and NATO stood ready to wage large-scale air-land battles. Fortunately for the Europeans, such a war never transpired on European soil. The closest thing to it took place in 1973, when the most intense mechanized war fighting since World War II occurred in the Yom Kippur War. By fighting this conflagration and by simultaneously catalyzing a global oil crisis, Sadat incentivized the superpowers, especially the United States, to step in and work toward a compromise solution. To plan the military dimensions of this strategy, Sadat and his innovative generals followed the advice of Sun Tzu, the famous Chinese thinker, who said that the first rule of good strategy is know thyself. They studied Egypt's failures in previous wars and fixed the problems that were fixable in a short period of time, such as training tank crews to hold their own ground. But as for the problems that could not be fixed, such as overcoming Israeli air superiority, they formulated a plan that minimized its importance. Some uninnovative Egyptian generals insisted that Israeli air superiority was an insurmountable obstacle. They argued that Egypt must first upgrade its air force before going to war with Israel. Such an upgrade would not have been quick or easy to do. The innovative generals rejected this view. If we're going to base our planning upon an adequate air force, we'll have to postpone the battle for years and years, they told Sadat. In fact, the gap between our air force and the enemies will tend to widen rather than to narrow. We therefore have no choice but to prepare for a battle under the conditions of enemy air superiority. Starting a war in the desert without air superiority might seem like an act of madness, but they had devised a novel plan. We can do it, they told Sadat, by challenging Israel's air superiority with SAMs. That is, surface-to-air missiles designed to knock planes out of the skies. At the end of the War of Attrition in early 1970, the Soviet Union began supplying the Egyptians, and the Syrians too, with state-of-the-art surface-to-air missiles. These were some of the finest systems in the world. If deployed in sufficient numbers, the Egyptians calculated, they would extend a SAM umbrella over the entire canal zone, extending 5 or 6 miles into Israeli-held Sinai. That distance was deep enough to allow the Egyptian military to cross the Suez Canal and grab the inches necessary to fulfill Sadat's goal. Now let's talk about Sadat's military deception. To deploy the element of surprise, Sadat and his generals staged a series of very elaborate and sophisticated ruses that desensitized the Israelis to the Egyptian preparations for war. For instance, between 1972 and 1973, the Egyptian army mobilized 22 times, approximately once a month. These lulled the Israelis to sleep. When the real thing came, the IDF just thought it was another routine exercise. But there may have also been a very different kind of deception, and that involves taking you on a bit of a tangent. I promise it'll be worth it. According to one school of thought, Sadat passed misinformation to the Israelis through a double agent named Ashraf Marwan. A trusted member of the ruling elite of Egypt, Ashraf Marwan was the son-in-law of Sadat's predecessor, President Gamal Abdel Nasser. The Mossad had been running Marwan as a source for years prior to the Yom Kippur War. During that time, he provided them with troves of invaluable information. The view of Marwan as a double agent rests on the idea that the true information he provided served as a lure that hooked the Israelis with misinformation about the most important thing of all, Sadat's true war plans. Indeed, some of what he fed the Israelis was inaccurate and had the effect of reinforcing ha-concepcia, the notion that Israel was so strong that the Egyptians would not dare to start a war. For example, Marwan told the Israelis that Sadat had concluded that he could not counter Israeli air superiority unless he acquired, among other things, long-range fighter bombers from the Soviet Union, which Sadat needed to conduct deep penetration raids into Israeli territory. Based on this information, the head of military intelligence, Major General Eli Zaira, whom we met in the previous episode, concluded that if the Russians refrained from delivering the bombers, Egypt would not go to war. In October 1973, Egypt didn't have the bombers, so Zaira was certain that the war was impossible. Ironically, Zaira seems to have believed that Marwan was a double agent, yet he also accepted Marwan's information on the bombers, perhaps because it was accepted or confirmed by other sources. In 2007, after Marwan died, he received a hero's farewell in Cairo. The head of Egyptian intelligence, Omar Suleiman, attended his funeral, as did President Hosni Mubarak's son, Gamal, who was also named after Gamal Abdel Nasser. As for Mubarak himself, he described Marwan as a patriot who had carried out patriotic acts which it is not yet time to reveal. Was this funeral itself an elaborate ruse? A second school of thought, a school to which I belong to, suspects that in fact it was. Ashraf Marwan died in mysterious circumstances. He fell from the balcony of his London apartment in 2007. The second school assumes that Egyptian intelligence killed him as punishment for treason. It identified him as a traitor in the early 2000s after his name and a description of the role that he played for the Mossad appeared in the Israeli press. I don't believe that Marwan was playing a double game for one simple reason. On October 5, he met in London with Tzvi Zamir, the head of Mossad, and informed him that a joint Egyptian-Syrian attack was going to take place the very next day. Marwan's message convinced Moshe Dayan and Golda Meir that war was coming. If his goal was to mislead, why would he have delivered such a message? Those who believe that he was a double agent counter that, yes, he did raise the alarm about the attack, but he said that the attack would start in the evening when actually it began at 2 in the afternoon. So, the idea being that he was providing misinformation even at that last stage. Whether Ashraf Marwan was a spy for Israel or a double agent, the way his information was absorbed into the Israeli intelligence system demonstrates how the feedback loop of ha-concepcia worked. In April 1973, Sadat intentionally misled the Israelis to believe that war was coming the next month. "I had no intention of starting a war in May," he wrote in his memoirs. "But as part of my strategic deception plan, I launched a mass media campaign then and took various civil defense measures, which led the Israelis to believe that war was imminent." The Israelis indeed carried out a partial mobilization in response to this ruse. The mobilization was economically and politically costly, but, and this is very important, it was not costly to Major General Zahira, the head of military intelligence. On the contrary, it bolstered his reputation. At the time, military intelligence was the only intelligence analysis unit in the country. Mossad collected intelligence, but it didn't analyze it. Zahira opposed the mobilization. He was convinced that it was not necessary. Sadat was not going to war, Zahira knew with certainty, because he didn't have the long-range bombers necessary to counter Israeli air superiority. Thus, Zahira emerged completely vindicated from the debate about whether to mobilize. He was also thoroughly convinced that he understood Sadat. When Egypt's actual war preparations began in early October, he insisted that they were nothing to worry about. He had seen it all before, and everyone else was inclined to believe him. After the Yom Kippur War, the Agranat Commission recommended that Zahira be dismissed, and he was. As we have seen, the Agranat report focused primarily on the element of surprise, on the absence of advance warning. Egypt and Syria massed thousands of tanks on two of Israel's borders. Israel's leaders received numerous advance reports, including a message delivered in person by King Hussein of Jordan, and yet they failed to see the war coming ahead of time. The director of military intelligence assured the IDF that he would be able to give advance warning of any enemy intention to launch all-out war in time to allow for the orderly call of the reserves, the report stated, and the IDF based its defensive plans on this claim. To this day, most Israelis believe that the Yom Kippur War went poorly because their enemies caught them unprepared, just like the IDF's success in 1967 came from catching the Egyptians and the Syrians unprepared. But as we analyze the event from the distance of half a century later, we can see that the element of surprise did less to shape the outcome than we might at first think. To be sure, General Zahira blundered severely. But the fact remains that the Israelis did receive warning of the attack. By the time Golda Meir met with her defense minister, Moshe Dayan, and her chief of staff, David Elazar, on the day that the war began, 4 or 5 hours remained before the Egyptian and Syrian armies would attack. Yet she chose not to launch a preemptive strike. Why? This question was not treated by the Agranat Commission's interim report. If we want to understand why 1973 was so different from 1967, we cannot look only to the failures of Israeli intelligence. We must ask why Israeli leaders rejected preemption, the tool that had stood Israel so well in 1967. In 2013, the Israeli government released the transcript of Golda Meir's testimony to the Agranat Commission. She explained that on the morning of October 6, when she learned of the impending attack, her heart was drawn, that's a quote, her heart was drawn to the idea of launching a preemptive strike, but her mind counseled against it. I was afraid, she said. Her fears centered not on how the Egyptians and the Syrians might respond, but on how she thought the Americans might respond. She understood that a major war might require the delivery of emergency supplies from the American military. If the Nixon administration were to conclude that Israel had started the war, or that Israel had provoked an Egyptian attack by ordering a major mobilization, the Americans might refuse to resupply or to slow the transfer of equipment. I can say with almost full confidence that if we had launched a preemptive strike, the American airlift would not have come through, the Prime Minister explained to the Agranat Commission. By waiting to absorb the Egyptian attack, she added, there could be no accusation that we started the war. She went on, I don't know if you know this, but the airlift did not go smoothly. She was indicating that even though the Israelis clearly had not started the war, there were still those in the American system, such as, for example, Secretary of Defense James Schlesinger, who were unsympathetic to Israel and would use every excuse that they had not to help. Meir further explained to the Agranat Commission that, in the hours before the war started, she told her colleagues in the government that, quote, 1973 is not 1967, and we won't be forgiven this time. Maybe some men would still die, but I don't know how many others would die because of the lack of equipment, unquote. In Meir's calculus, a preemptive strike would have saved the lives of some Israeli soldiers up front. But by scuttling the American resupply, it would have taken the lives of many others on the back end. On October 23, 1973, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger convened a meeting of his senior staff to review American policy during the war, which was just now coming to an end. There have been many stories that we prevented a preemptive attack by the Israelis, and that their setbacks are due to our urging them not to engage in a preemptive attack. This is total nonsense, he said. He was bothering to raise the issue, he further explained, because he feared that a quote-unquote myth might develop according to which American, quote, influence prevented the Israelis from forestalling the attack by using a preemptive move, unquote. The official American documents do not fully support the account that Kissinger offered his staff. An aide awakened Kissinger at 6:15 on Saturday morning, October 6, with a message from Golda Meir, informing Kissinger that war was coming and that Israel did not have plans to carry out a preemptive attack. Kissinger's first move at 6:40 a.m. was to call Alexei Dobrynin, the Soviet ambassador to the United States, to inform him that the Israelis wanted the Soviets to know that they had no intention to attack, but also that the United States was, quote, warning against a precipitous move. At 6:55, Kissinger then called Mordechai Shalev, a senior Israeli diplomat in Washington, and said, quote, we would like to urge you not to take any preemptive action, because the situation will get very serious if you move, unquote. At 7 a.m., he called the Egyptian foreign minister and informed him, I have just called the Israelis, and I have informed them that if Israel attacks, that we would take a very serious view of the situation, and I have told them on behalf of the United States that Israel must not attack, no matter what they think the provocation is, unquote. We can only imagine the joy that the Soviets and the Egyptians felt when they received the news from Kissinger that the United States was restraining Israel. This was a rare blunder by Kissinger. Some authors have adduced it to strengthen the claim, which I mentioned earlier, that he sought, quote unquote, to bleed Israel. I reject this interpretation. I will explore Kissinger's diplomacy in greater depth at a later episode. For the moment, suffice it to say that the Secretary of State, like every Israeli leader at that moment, believed that the war would be very short and that Israel would win with ease. Kissinger was likely trying to prevent an Israeli blowout that would force a direct Soviet response of the kind that we had seen in the War of Attrition in 1970. He may also have been trying to preserve some kind of balance that would allow for American mediation. Be that as it may, the difference between American and Soviet policy was stark. Washington worked to restrain its ally, which was about to be attacked, while Moscow, after arming its allies for war, got out of their way. To understand why Israel behaved differently in 1973 from 1967, the restraining hand of the United States is a factor that we must not ignore. Now let's turn to analyzing the main events on the battlefield. At 2 p.m. on October 6, Egypt and Syria attacked simultaneously. In the north, five Syrian army divisions with 1,400 tanks and 1,000 pieces of artillery attacked the two Israeli brigades on the Golan, which had only 177 tanks and 50 pieces of artillery. Meanwhile, five Egyptian infantry divisions with nearly 100,000 soldiers, 1,300 tanks, and 2,000 artillery pieces launched themselves across the Suez Canal to fight 450 Israeli soldiers. Most of the Israelis in the Sinai were poorly trained reservists who had seen little combat. They manned a chain of defensive structures called the Bar Lev Line, standing behind a huge sand barrier which the Israelis built along the banks of the canal. The Bar Lev line included a series of 16 small forts that were too far apart to give each other effective fire support. The speed of the Egyptian attack owes much to the talent, training, and leadership of the Egyptian Engineering Corps. These men did more to influence events than their flashy compatriot, the spy Ashraf Marwan. But unlike their compatriot in London, Netflix will never make a movie about them. Two innovations of the Egyptian engineers deserve special mention. First, they developed a special tool for cutting a path through the giant sand berms, water cannon. Water sucked from the canal fed into high-pressure water cannons imported from Europe, which quickly washed away the dunes. Second, the engineers constructed pontoon bridges that allowed the Egyptian tanks to roll onto the east bank of the canal once the way had been cut through the sand. Built in sections, the bridges were easily repaired when damaged by Israeli fire. After crossing the canal, the Egyptian forces, protected from Israeli air power by the SAM umbrella, moved through the wide gaps between the Bar Lev fortifications with relative ease. The Israeli war plan relied on the Air Force to slow the advance in time to bring up the reserves, but nothing prepared the Israeli pilots for the surface-to-air missiles that they encountered. In 1967, the pilots had seemed invincible. Just 6 years later, they lost about 30% of their operational aircraft in the first 24 hours of the conflict. The mobile SAM-6s, new to the theater, were especially lethal. But the sheer number of missiles, the density of the fire, posed the biggest challenge. Quote, "It was like flying through hail," said one Israeli pilot. The skies were suddenly filled with SAMs, and it required every bit of concentration to avoid being hit," unquote. SAM-6s were not the only cutting-edge system the Egyptians deployed with creativity. Their combat infantry crossed the canal with portable SAGR anti-tank guided missiles. At the time, a typical rocket-propelled grenade remained accurate only up to a few hundred yards. By contrast, the SAGRs had a range of up to 2 miles. To protect themselves from Israeli counterattacks, the Egyptian teams would deploy a launcher on the ground and then take cover nearby. From the position of relative safety, they would fire the projectile toward the approaching tanks. A long wire remained connected to the missiles during the entire flight, with the operator using a joystick to direct it at its target. Having gone to school on Israeli military doctrine, the Egyptians understood that the Israeli tank commanders would counterattack at the first opportunity. On October 8, the Israelis behaved exactly as expected. The SAGR operators turned that date into the most infamous in the history of the IDF. The SAGR warheads blasted through the armor of Israel's patent tanks with ease. In one day, Israel lost 100 tanks. By the 9th of October, Egypt's anti-tank missile teams had brought Israel's counterattack to a complete standstill. One Israeli tank unit lost 22 of 25 tanks in a 5-minute period. All told, the Israelis lost about 1,000 tanks in the war, most of them to the SAGR missiles. The war consumed Israeli planes, tanks, and munition stocks at an alarming rate. When Golda Meir turned to Washington for aid, the Nixon administration at first dragged its feet, apparently because it feared a Soviet countermove, a major reaction among America's Arab allies, and again, because it assumed that an Israeli victory was imminent. As it turned out, the Egyptians were so successful that they tried to press their advantage too far, with disastrous results. Starting around October 14, the same day that the American airlift began, the tide of war in Sinai shifted in favor of Israel. That night, General Elazar called Golda Meir with, for the first time, an optimistic assessment of the war in the Sinai. "Golda, it will be all right," he said. "We are back to ourselves, and the Egyptians are back to themselves." What suddenly changed? Answering that question takes us up north to the fighting with Syria on the Golan Heights. Like the Egyptians, the Syrian soldiers of 1973 were also much better trained than they were in 1967. And they too advanced rapidly against the Israelis in the first day of the war. But in contrast to their Egyptian allies, they lost their advantage very quickly. By day two, they were stopped in their tracks. By day three, the Israelis were already pushing them back. Assad's campaign in the north failed to mimic Sadat's campaign in the south, partly because the Syrians failed to raise an impregnable SAM umbrella. More importantly, the traditional superiority of the Israelis at maneuver warfare allowed them to win engagements involving a small number of tanks against numerically larger Syrian formations. On numerous critical occasions, fire from Israeli tanks that were vastly outnumbered intimidated Syrian commanders who called off promising attacks. If the Syrians had pressed their early advantage, an opportunity existed, unique in the history of the Arab-Israeli conflict, to surround and neutralize all Israeli defenders on the Golan. From there, the Syrians could have stormed down to the Galilee, like the wolf on the fold, to steal a line from Lord Byron. But a small number of heroic Israeli defenders stopped the Syrian advance long enough to allow large numbers of reserves into the Golan. The speed with which the tide of war turned in the north changed the course of history and snatched from the Arab coalition a triumph analogous to the Israeli victory in 1967. By October 11, the Israelis had driven the attackers out of the Golan and were already advancing in the direction of Damascus. In a panic, Hafez al-Assad reportedly made frantic calls for assistance to Sadat, demanding that the Egyptian army exploit its advantage and continue eastward into the Mitla and Gidi mountain passes in central Sinai. Assad was begging Sadat to hit the Israelis harder in the south to stop them from attacking his capital. The Egyptian war plan did not condition Sadat to respond favorably to Assad's pleas for help. An advance to the Sinai passes would take the Egyptian armor outside of the protection of the SAM umbrella, Israel's air superiority, and its huge tactical advantage in maneuver warfare would rush back into play. These were precisely the factors that had given Israel its advantage in 1967, and they would inevitably offset, indeed nullify, the capabilities that Egypt's innovative war plan had generated. But suddenly, Sadat threw caution to the winds and answered Assad's calls for help. His exact calculus is unclear, but he gave the order for Egyptian armored columns to leave the shelter of the SAM umbrella and to advance on the passes. The results were catastrophic for Egypt. On October 14, the Egyptian 3rd Armored Brigade launched an attack toward the Mitla Pass with 124 tanks. In less than 8 hours, it lost 60 tanks, 9 armored personnel carriers, and virtually all its artillery pieces. By the end of the day, IDF intelligence estimated that the Egyptians had lost, in total, 280 tanks, enough to shift the balance in favor of Israel. Which brings us back to Elazar's call to Golda Meir. His remark about the Israelis and the Egyptians having reverted to type occurred on the night of October 14th. The statement was true in the sense that the Israelis now enjoyed the upper hand, but some of the worst fighting of the war still awaited them. Determined to press their advantage, the Israeli command developed a plan to deliver a knockout blow to the Egyptians. Codenamed Stout-Hearted Men, the operation called for General Ariel Sharon to secure a crossing to the west side of the canal, which would allow 3 Israeli armored divisions to encircle the Egyptian Third Army, the key force holding the territory on the Asian side of the canal. Feeling that they were now back in 1967, the Israelis optimistically planned for Stout-Hearted Men to be complete in just 2 days. But the Egyptians fought for every inch. Over the next 5 days, starting on October 14th, the most intensive tank battle since World War II took place. On the night of the 15th, the fighting was particularly gruesome in western Sinai at a place called the Chinese Farm. Ariel Sharon, one of the greatest Israeli heroes of the war, describes the carnage in his memoirs. "It was as if a hand-to-hand battle of armor had taken place," he writes. "Coming close, you could see Egyptian and Jewish dead lying side by side, soldiers who had jumped from their burning tanks and died together. No picture could capture the horror of that scene. On our side that night, we had lost 300 dead and hundreds more wounded." But Sharon pressed on from the battle and secured a crossing across the canal. This opening allowed Israeli forces to threaten the rear of the Egyptian Third Army, which was holding the southwest tip of the Sinai Peninsula. The Egyptians were about to lose their foothold in Sinai. Fearing total defeat, the Egyptian president appealed for a ceasefire. The war took an enormous toll on both sides. In terms of absolute numbers, however, the Arab coalition suffered much more than the Israelis. The Egyptians and the Syrians lost approximately 15,000 men in the war, with around 35,000 wounded. The Israelis lost 2,500, with 7,251 wounded. The Egyptians and Syrians lost 440 airplanes, Israel 102. The Arab coalition lost 2,250 tanks, compared with around 1,000 Israeli tanks, many of which were repaired and returned to full service. The Arab coalition lost 770 cannons, Israel 25. 12 Arab missile boats were sunk. The Israelis lost none. Thanks to the Agronaut report, the breakdown in the early warning system of Israeli intelligence will always loom large in Israeli consciousness. However, the breakdown played a much larger role in influencing popular sentiment, in shaking national confidence, than it did in actually shaping the war. Even if Elie Zaira had read the signals from Egypt more accurately and had provided a warning 48 or 72 hours earlier, the outcome of the war was unlikely to have been appreciably different. This is true for two reasons. First, the Israelis failed to imagine the nature of the coming conflict. Military intelligence officers instinctively love things that can be photographed, tested, and compared. They therefore love tangible things, such as tanks and planes. They also revel in quantifiable things, such as ranges of artillery pieces and the throw weights of missiles. Conversely, they hate intangibles, such as morale, which is effervescent, differs from unit to unit, and is hard to measure. The thing they hate most of all is intention, the least tangible thing in the world. No one has ever captured an intention on a satellite image. Yet predicting enemy behavior requires a military intelligence officer to read the intentions of the enemy. To get around the problem of intangibility, officers typically work on the assumption that capabilities are intentions. The officer tracks tangible warfighting assets of enemy forces and deduces the intention of the enemy leaders based on the readiness and disposition of those forces. Major General Zaira's misreading of the obvious signs of an Egyptian and Syrian attack resulted from an extreme version of this mode of thought. He mistakenly assumed that the absence of long-range fighter bombers in Sadat's arsenal signaled an absence of intentions to make war. So strongly did Zaira adhere to fighter bombers as the decisive indicator that even as Egypt massed tanks, artillery, and pontoon bridges on Israel's border, he confidently assumed Sadat was bluffing. On the morning of the Egyptian attack, he assessed the probability of war as low. While Zaira has been pilloried for this error, the more consequential mistake in retrospect was failing to glean Egyptian concepts of operation, CONOPS for short. CONOPS is a useful bit of military jargon. It refers to the way a commander combines existing weapons and capabilities to solve a military problem, to the art rather than the science of war. Or, to put it differently, not simply what you have, but how you intend to deploy it. As a verifiable object of analysis, CONOPS reside one step removed from tangible capabilities. They are real enough, like plans, but hard for military intelligence officers to photograph, let alone measure. They can therefore fall through the cracks of standard methodologies. Sadat's CONOPS certainly fell through the cracks. His opening punches hit the Israelis like an anvil in the face because he combined known capabilities in a completely unexpected way. He produced an early version of what military specialists today call anti-access aerial denial, or A2AD strategy. That is, It involved using the surface-to-air missiles to make Israeli attacks on certain areas impossible. Thanks especially to China's efforts to make the South China Sea inhospitable to the United States Navy, the term A2AD has become fashionable in foreign policy analyses of late. And indeed, A2AD shapes the modern battlefield. But it was not always so. The strategy made its debut on the world stage in the Yom Kippur War. Even if Zaira had predicted the timing of the attack correctly, the innovative Egyptian CONOPS would have surprised the Israeli forces and the Americans as well. Second, an accurate early warning from Zaira would not have changed the course of events because Golda Meir and Moshe Dayan would not have changed their minds about launching a preemptive strike or mobilizing reserves. Both moves would have defied the will of Henry Kissinger to keep things quiet, to avoid provocation, to ensure that Israel would not be held responsible for starting the war. Because the United States was equally blind to the power of Sadat's CONOPS, it overestimated the power of Israel and, as a result, felt comfortable in deterring and thereby weakening its own ally. The historical record on this matter cannot be clearer. But the issue does not receive the attention it deserves, because introducing the theme of American deterrence would subvert a pleasing morality tale. The Agronaut Commission report inadvertently helped to construct a story of Israeli hubris that attracts all of those, both inside and outside of Israel, who want to believe that Israeli intransigence or militarism is the primary obstacle to peace. In addition, the tale of hubris resonates on a deep cultural level. It's a manifestation of the myth of Icarus, whose wings of wax melted when he flew too close to the sun. It's not so much that the Agronaut Commission was wrong. Israeli leaders and officers were overconfident about their own capabilities in the face of the Arabs, just as they were overly confident in their intelligence capabilities. But neither explains why Israel didn't preempt, or even why it wasn't better prepared. In the next lecture, I'll take you into the mind of Sadat. I'll explain how he arrived at the innovative strategy that astounded the world. The important point here is that Sadat was engaging the Israelis in addition to engaging the Americans. He had departed from Nasser's approach of simply borrowing American power to roll back Israel, and he was actively seeking to change the psychology in Jerusalem. One actor who recognized the change was the American Assistant Secretary of State, Joe Sisko.